WMFO in Medford. It's 9 a.m. Oh, really ticking quickly towards 9:01 a.m. I'm Mike. How are you doing? I'll be here until 11 a.m. when Something About the Women comes in. And today I'm very psyched, as I am every day, but today even more so, because I've been waiting for this gentleman to come in and so I could help him with parking and talk about headphones and technology in general. But I've got somebody named Fred Pinot right across from me smiling. Smile, Fred, to make it true.
I'm too tired not to smile.
Yeah, tell me about it. I didn't sleep much at all. But Fred, and I'll let you talk about this, you know, more than I. But currently, you know, Fred is still very much into our awesome Boston music scene. He's in Little Billy Lost, ripping up the guitar. And of course, we know you from the Atlantics. I don't want to say way back when, but, you know, back when it happened.
Oh, it was way back when.
It was way back when. Yeah, I know. I tried to save it, but sometimes I can't do it. But maybe, Fred, we'll just start off with a real quick sort of synopsis of how you sort of got into playing the guitar and bands and where you grew up. Just a little bit of background, if you would.
Sure. Yeah. I'll have to do this quickly in a real synopsis because I'm old.
Yeah.
So I grew up in, I was born in Brookline, Mass., which is a wealthy town, but we were a poor family in a wealthy town. So that was an interesting dichotomy. Mm. My father was an entertainer. He was a vaudeville musician. And
oh, really?
He performed right up till the time he died at age 64 in 1964. So I grew up in show business. I grew up watching people do live performance. But I never had any interest in myself until I was 12 years old. I got into vinyl records. My parents got me a tiny little record player, and somebody gave me a stack of 45s, and one of them was Rumble by Link Wray and the Raymen.
Oh, I've heard that so often about Link Wray.
And yeah. I just listened to it, and 2 minutes and 30 seconds later, my life had changed. I wanted to make that noise on the guitar. I didn't know what it was or how it was done. So for about 2 years, I pulled my father's guitar out whenever he wasn't around and tinker with it. But I sort of played, but I really wasn't that serious. Then in 64, the Beatles came on Ed Sullivan, and that was the end of that.
February 9th, 1964.
Yeah, I really wanted to do that.
Yeah.
And on the heels of that, I was starting high school. And in my high school, they had a big concert every year. And that year, it was the Kingsmen, you know, the guys from Louie Louie fame.
Yep, yep.
And the opening acts, the very first act was the Remains, the Boston band, the Remains. And they started playing, and halfway through their first song, I said, okay, this is what I want to do, and that's how I want to do it. And I ended up following the Remains around Boston wherever I could get in as a kid, and pestering the hell out of them. And they were always very nice to me, and they were still one of the best live rock bands I've ever seen.
Hmm.
That's how I sort of started, and I'm all self-taught. I was so insecure about my playing that I never really got in an actual band until I was about 18.
And do you read music, or is it just...
No.
Okay.
No, you know what? I came... My father did.
Yeah.
I came to a juncture, and I knew I had to either become schooled and learn to read music and write music and so forth, or not. And my heroes were all people who didn't read and write. My heroes were Chuck Berry and the blues artists, you know, Hubert Sumlin and people like that. The Beatles, who don't read and write music. The Stones, you know, all of these people were people who were the people I wanted to emulate.
Yep.
And they didn't read or write. So I said, you know what, I'm just going to play from the heart and the crotch and not the head. and that's the course I chose. And when I was 18, I started getting into regular bands, and I always wanted to write my own music because in the 60s, I got into alternative before people were really into it. I listened to the Mothers of Invention when they first came out. I listened to the Velvet Underground, who were a huge influence on me. I bought that first album in 67 when the first album came out. I put it on, and he's singing a love song to heroin. I said, I didn't know you could do that, you know? So,
well, couldn't before then.
No, it just sort of changed my life, and I've never done drugs, but I just love the idea that you could make that statement. And so I put together original bands, and at that time nobody booked original bands, so it was a wasteland. But I was in a band very early on, maybe around 70, 71, called Ozone Shirley, which we played on the Cambridge Common and different places like that. And then I was in a band called Automatic Slim, which was a really good band. If that had been around in the mid-70s, I think it could have done something. Our bass player in that band was John Havorka of the Turbines. And then I went for that to another band. All of these bands were playing like six times a year because we couldn't get shows because we played original music.
Oh, okay.
And that band, a band called Astral Projection, that had, this is probably 72, 73, 74 in there, that had Joe Viglione on vocals. And that broke up. And then I put together a band called Bonjour Aviators. Now, that band, we got a, one of the guys in the band, Kim Preston, was, he grew up with Richard Lloyd from television.
Uh-huh.
So he was talking to Richard one day, and he said to me, you know, there's an original music scene happening in New York that's starting to take off. It's at this club CBGB's and this club Max's Kansas City. And Richard says we ought to go down there and start playing. I said, I'll go anywhere, you know, because we couldn't get a show in Boston.
Mm.
So we started driving down to New York. We would stay at the Chelsea Hotel. Sometimes we'd stay at Terry Ork's loft. He was the manager of television. And we were hanging around at CBGB's and Max's when all of that was just starting. And for a very first show we played at CBGB's, we opened for Talking Heads when they were a three-piece. We ended up going on to, we did some shows with television, Patti Smith, we were on the bill the very first night that the Dead Boys played at CBGB's.
Uh-huh.
I mean, there was a lot of great memories from that.
So Bonjour Aviators is the one where you actually just started to, I just want to do this. And you moved yourselves to New York. And like you said, you started to be able to play with these well-known bands. They weren't then.
Point taken. Very first night we played, I tell this story often. I was on stage. We were playing the night we opened for Talking Heads, and about halfway through a solo I was doing, I looked up and Debbie Harry was standing 6 feet away from me, and I have it burned into my memory. She's one of the most beautiful women I've ever seen, but she was wearing a sleeveless red top, a black leather miniskirt, black nylons, and like 5-inch stiletto heels.
There you go.
And I swear to God, I lost my place in the song, you know. And then she and Chris Stein were there. We hung out at the bar. And I mean, that's what it was. It was just a local scene back then, mm-hmm. you know. So that was the first band. Then the Rat opened up.
Yeah, so you came back.
Well, no, we didn't move there. We just kept traveling there.
I see.
And then the Rat opened up, and
changed everything.
Well, yeah. And somebody said, well, here's the story behind the story, though. Somebody said the Rat's opening up to original music, and it was always cover bands. And they said they're just starting to let original bands play. So I called Jimmy Harold, and he said, come down like at 4 in the afternoon on Wednesday. And so I went down there, and I talked to him, and he basically said that the Kenmore Club across the street, which was Lucifer's and those three clubs, were killing him. And they could get all the best cover bands, so he couldn't book them. So he said, I'm doing this as kind of a Hail Mary pass. So we booked in Bonjour Aviators. I think we were the third or fourth band to ever play there. And we went in. We had to do 3 50-minute sets. There were no other bands.
That's rough.
Yeah, that was real rough. And Jimmy was on his game, too, because we did three sets, and we didn't know that much material. So the third set, toward the end, we threw in a few songs we had done in the first set. I came off stage at the third set. He said, you repeated some songs. I said,
thanks for paying attention.
Yeah, was that? what can I do? But anyway, then the Rat took off, and I went from Bonjour Aviators to Third Rail, which was another Boston band with Richard Nolan, and then from Third Rail to the Atlantics.
And we'll talk a lot about your experiences with the Atlantics. I just got a question for you. When the Rat started to sort of employ that Hail Mary, how did audiences at the Rat who hadn't experienced, you know, original music, how did they react at first, way back then?
Well, they did something really smart. The college radio, of course, and I said this when we were inducted into the New England Music Hall of Fame. I was on stage doing my speech, and I said this. I said, college radio is the life's blood of new music. And college radio was playing all of these bands, all of these alternative kind of bands that nobody else was playing.
Mm-hmm.
And they ended up reaching out to college radio DJs who began pumping it. Now, at that time, the drinking age was 18. So college kids, college freshmen could go to bars.
Mm-hmm.
So college radio began pumping it. You know, everybody was, young people were listening to college radio. So the crowds, they weren't like out the door right away, but you would get people every night. You would get people every night, Tuesday night, Wednesday night, because they were college kids. And the response was generally really positive.
Nice.
And it really helped.
Yeah, it was the right audience.
Oh,
yeah.
No doubt.
Yeah.
And, you know, I many nights I remember going down the route just to hang out. And, like, one of the very first times they played there, I saw the Stompers. And they went up on stage, and like halfway through their second song, I was riveted. I said, this is a great band. So you had those experiences there. You got to see all these bands, and it didn't matter what type of band you were. You could get up there, and you could have like four bands up that night, and you know, they could have really nothing generally in common, but everybody would listen and everybody would respond. So it was a wonderful scene.
Okay, so you sort of mentioned, you definitely mentioned the Atlantics. For me, anyway, that's sort of what I associate you with. And that band brought you all kinds of opportunities, including of seeing the world, touring around, meeting all kinds of bands, either opening for them, seeing them in the audience, per your example. All kinds of great things must have happened. So when we had talked earlier in the week, we had mentioned sort of some of your more interesting memories of some of these experiences. And one of the bands you mentioned, which blows me away, is Queen.
Mm-hmm.
So tell us about the Atlantics and your personal experiences with Queen and the Atlantics.
Sure. We were playing, I think it was the last time we ever played at the Rat, actually. The Atlantics were playing five nights in a row at the Rat, headlining. And we were just about to leave for New York to record the Big City Rock album for ABC Records. And we were up there on stage playing, and there was this really tall guy walking around the Rat. He was head and shoulders above everybody else. And as we were coming off stage, I said to our road manager, Billy Budd, I said, you know, there's a guy wandering around. It looks like Brian May. And he said, it is Brian May. He said, they're tomorrow night, they're kicking off the tour, the United States tour for the jazz album at the Boston Garden. He said they were looking, he and John Deacon were looking for something to do tonight. And somebody at BCN told them, hey, go down and see the Atlantics. You'll like them.
Get out.
So they were there. And we all ended up in the dressing room, which was, of course, the boiler room at the Rat.
Mm-hmm.
And Brian and I really hit it off. We'd be talking like real gearhead stuff about amps and guitars and different things. And he was telling me the story of how he and his father built his first guitar, and what is actually the guitar he still plays. We just were talking about a variety of different things. And he finally said, well, you guys need to come down tomorrow night and see us. And I said, I think we can pencil that in.
Yeah.
You know? And we ended up going down the next night to the Boston Garden and seeing a phenomenal show. I mean, what a live band. They were just amazing.
Now, did you get to go and watch it side stage, or did you get...
No, they had us in... they had seating that was for, like, I don't know, for lack of a better term, VIP seating.
Okay.
So we were watching from that seating, and then we went backstage and hung with them. You know, I had a really, one of the most moving experiences I've had is we were backstage and, you know, met everybody and just sort of hanging out and talking. And, and by the way, they were all such nice people. They're very, very nice people. And at that point, they were on top of the world. I mean, this is 1978, you know. So Brian said to me, come here for a second. So we stepped to the side and he said, you know, how did I sound, you know, during Tie Your Mother Down? And I said, well, Brian, I said, the whole concert pretty much sounded like the records. It really was good. He said, yeah, but how was my tone? Like, I thought it was a little mid-rangey, and so we started talking about that, and he kept asking me about different songs, this song and that song, and how did I sound here? And I said, you know, now that I think of it, I noticed you kept going back to your amp and tweaking it. He goes, yeah. He said, I couldn't get it in the pocket. I couldn't get it exactly where I wanted it. And finally, I said to him, I said, Brian, why should you care what I think? I said, you know, you've sold at this point, 30 million albums? I've sold 8. I said, why? And he said something I want carved on my tombstone. He said, because I really like your sound and I respect your opinion.
Oh, man.
And I said, wow. I mean, that was like an out-of-body experience. And it just spoke to the type of person he is. He's a real gentleman. And you know, he came down, he saw us play, he liked my sound, and I mean, that alone just is, you know, and that's the stuff you see in movies. But, so we ended up having a very good experience hanging out with them, you know.
And was that the only time back then? You must have run into them again.
No.
Never, ever? Never, no.
No. You know, and clearly I'm a Queen fan. I love Queen. But, our roads, paths never crossed again. Yeah.
So. Wow.
But it's okay. It's all right. I'll take that.
Oh, sure. All right. So let's talk about maybe some of your favorite songs from Queen. We talked about a couple of them. Mm. We talked about Waiting for the Hammer to Fall.
Yeah, I love that song.
And the thing about Queen, just to remind our audience, you know, nobody ever heard anything like them. Those voice arrangements that they did had never been done like that. So these songs that you have picked, Waiting for the Hammer to Fall and Killer Queen, those are right on display, right up front.
Oh, by the way, another interesting maybe little tidbit is he told me how they recorded that, those vocals.
Yeah.
He said all four of them were just great singers. And he said that we would all harmonize on that stuff. And they would do multi-track recordings of their vocals, but they would take whatever the harmony parts were, they would do, okay, we're going to do harmony number one, and all four of them would do harmony number one and record it.
Wow.
Then all four of them would do harmony number two and record it. Then number three. And that's how they would put those layered vocals together. They would sing these harmony parts. They wouldn't sing them the way they did live. They would all sing exactly the same part and then layer them one on top of the other.
That's interesting because two things. You speak of that as like boom, boom, boom. They'd do multi-tracks with harmony one, two, or three. That's not an easy thing to do.
No.
At all. I mean, you've got to be extremely. And number two, I suppose, so their live rendition of those harmonies and the recordings never were sounding the same because the recorded ones always had that extra. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I never knew that.
They were very dense, yeah. And you're right. I mean, nobody... And, certainly part of that goes down to Roy Thomas Baker, their producer. He was just... What a great producer he was. I mean, he produced so many fantastic bands back then, but including the Cars. And, but that type of vocal layering, I think, was very innovative. But you're right. You needed people with the talent to pull it off.
Do you know if they tried to replicate that playing live, or they just had a whole different set of vocal requirements when they played live?
No, they just sang. The only time that they used a recorded track was
that's where I was going
when they did Bohemian Rhapsody, and the whole middle section of Bohemian Rhapsody, they just walked off stage and recording played and they did things with the lights
shows,
and stuff,
yeah.
You know, and then they would come back and they would do the rock part of it and finish it off.
I guess that would be too much to ask for anybody to be able to do that live.
They seemed to be doing the vocals. All four of them sang, you know, Freddie certainly, and the other three were, especially Roger Taylor, who just incredible vocalists.
Crazy.
Oh, yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I didn't know all that. I mean, Freddie, it's obvious what he could do. He would not show it off, but put it on display for the audiences when he would have that call and response.
Well, you know what that
was? Everybody knew.
You know what that was? Those were his vocal warm-ups.
Warm-ups.
Yeah, those were his vocal warm-ups.
Yeah.
Those are the exercises.
Clever.
He did. Yeah. One day he just did it and crowd responded, so he kept doing it, you know? It's just really funny stuff. But, as in the pantheon of lead vocalists, you know, he's one of those amazing guys where you can hear a song that you don't know, but the minute you hear him open his mouth, you know exactly who it is.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right, so let's just have a listen to some of these some of these songs and some of these harmonies that we're talking about. The first one that we mentioned, and I mentioned it before, is Waiting for the Hammer to Fall.
Mm.
Just a quick little comment on why that song sort of stands out to you.
One of the reasons is it's more of a rock song than Queen usually did. When I was talking to Freddie, I mentioned something about that to him, and he said, not that you're not a rock band, but you don't do a traditional kind of rock. And he goes, yeah, he says, anytime Brian comes up with something that sounds the least bit bluesy, I just say, no, I don't want to do that.
That's not us.
Yeah, that's not us.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know what else to say. The Hammer to Fall is more rock than they usually did. More like hammer down rock. And I think that's one of the reasons I really love it. You know, of course, Killer Queen is just, you know, their business card in terms of those vocals.
I was going to say that's much more representative of who they are. Mm. And the vocals in there are nothing at all like Waiting for the Hammer to Fall. It's ubiquitous kind of classic Queen vocals in Killer Queen.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so why don't we hear those two, starting with Waiting for the Hammer to Fall.
Okay.
All right, turn it up, everybody. This is WMFO in Medford.
she says, just like Marie Antoinette, a building, a remedy for Khrushchev and Kennedy. At any time, an invitation you can't decline. Caviar and cigarettes, well versed in etiquette, extraordinarily nice. She's a killer queen, gunpowder gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. To avoid complications, she never kept the same address. In conversation, she spoke just like a baroness. Middleman from China went down to gauge her mind. Then again, incidentally, she knew that way. Because she couldn't care less, fastidious and precise. She's a killer queen, gunpowder gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Momentarily out of action, temporarily out of class, you absolutely try. She's out to get you. She's a killer queen, gunpowder gelatine, dynamite with a laser beam, guaranteed to blow your mind. Recommended at the price, insatiable and appetite. Wanna try?
It's 9:30 in the morning here at WMFO Medford. I'm Mike, here with Fred Pinot. Hey, Fred.
Hey, Mike.
So, yeah, I mean, it's one thing talking about a band and then hearing their stuff. Mm. I mean, those two songs from Queen just demonstrably sort of show what we're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, as I mentioned many times, we have some great JBL speakers in here.
Mm.
And we had them up loud. And those songs, the great songs, never get old.
Yeah, yeah, I agree totally. It's, I think that's part of the mark of a really sort of legendary band is that their material never really ages. It's,
yeah,
you know, people that hear it today for the first time are interested in it just as much as they were back then.
Mm-hmm. Definitely harder to do than it sounds.
Oh, yeah.
Because, I mean, if you think about how many songs are out and how many bands there are,
mm-hmm.
you know. All right, so let's sort of talk about another artist who people of a certain age would know very well, and I'm within that age, and I think you might be. I don't know.
A little bit.
Maybe.
Yeah.
But a guy that really had one of those artists who was everywhere, and deservedly so, a guy named Robert Palmer.
Yeah,
you
absolutely.
Know? And I know that you had a chance to interact with him as well.
Yeah, we opened a show for him at the Paris Theater up in Maine. I can't remember exactly which city it was in. But we were opening a show. It ended up being a real education because we went to open the show for him. And normally, we did a lot of concert work, opening shows for bigger recording artists. And the usual way it worked was, you know, the opening act goes on, we play our show, they go on and play their show,
yeah.
and then you might end up hanging around a little bit afterwards. But we went on stage, and I was like, well, a few things happened. Halfway through the second song, I broke my high E string. And at that time, I foolishly did not have a backup guitar.
Fred.
So I had to play the entire rest of our show thinking ahead to the next song and figuring how I was going to take the solo with five strings.
Yeah.
And halfway through all this, I look over and Robert Palm is standing side stage watching us. And he stayed there for our entire show, which kind of amazed me because he had to go on.
Did that surprise you that he was out of the corner of your eye?
Oh,
there
yeah.
He is? Yeah.
Oh, yeah. He's standing there like, you know, nodding his head. I could tell he was into it. And I'm thinking to myself, oh, great. You know, the one time somebody's standing
exactly.
watching our show and I'm broken a string and I've got to do, you know. So we came off stage and we went to the dressing room and he came back to our dressing room and sat down and sort of chatted with us. And, you know, and I said to him at one point, I said, geez, Robert, I said, I broke my high E string and yada, yada, yada. I said, I'm sorry, I wasn't at my best. He goes, all right. He said, I thought it sounded okay.
All right.
And it was sort of a good barometer for when you're on stage and you mess up and you think it's the end of the world and no one picks up on it.
Nobody would know, but no. I totally understand that.
So, then, you know, he had obviously had to leave and do his show. So he did his show, which was fantastic. I mean, what a vocalist. What an incredible voice he had. And so then we ended up in his dressing room afterwards. He had a pretty big dressing room. And while we were in there, I think he was on EMI Records at the time. The EMI local rep was there. And he got this guy and he dressed him down from top to bottom.
Oh, no.
He was really in his face about, you didn't promote this show the way you should have, and blah, 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 blah. And the guy kept trying to argue the point. And Robert, like, had all of his ducks in line. He knew exactly what he was talking about. And so when he finished with the guy, I went over to him and I said, Robert, I don't think I've ever seen anybody dress down their record company guy like that. He goes, sit down. He said, let me give you a little tutorial on how you need to do this, you know, how you need to behave in this business. And he talked to me for about 15 minutes about, you are the only one that looks out for you. He said, you know, it's great if you have a good manager, but he said, at the end of the day, it comes down to you. You've got to know exactly what's going on. And it was really eye-opening. I mean, I sort of knew it, but I, you know, to hear him sit down and kind of lay it out in black and white was really interesting. And he was, again, very, very nice person, very giving, clearly watched the opening acts show. You know, he did a lot of stuff that a lot of the people we opened for didn't do. You know, I ended up being really impressed with him, and we lost him way too young.
Way too young. And just sort of keying off what you said, during that time, during his career, MTV happened. And
yes.
Just him telling you to watch out for yourself. Do you know anything about that extremely crazy video that he did with those women that he had made up to really resemble each other completely over a song that he must have known was just going to be huge, Addicted to Love.
Mm.
What do you know, if anything, about that video?
That came after I met him, so I don't know anything about it, really. But
I bet it didn't surprise you that he...
No. I mean, I think he was out in front of what he wanted to be doing in his career. You know, he wasn't relying on his management and the record company to tell him what to do or to guide him or to insist that he, you know, I can't ever imagine after that experience having record companies we were on two major labels. Record companies are kind of famous for telling you what they want you to do.
Mm-hmm.
A good example of that was, we were on MCA Records, and they dropped us eventually, and then they wanted to re-sign us after the Knack hit with My Sharona, because they said, who do we have with the skinny ties and the, you know,
yeah.
And they said, oh, the Atlantic. So they had us come to New York, and we went for a meeting with the East Coast president, and he said to us, we had Lonely Hearts in the can at that time, but it hasn't been released.
Yeah.
And he said,
and the record company knew of it, had
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay. Yeah, they heard it. And he said, I heard it. I think it's a great song. I think it could be a hit, no problem. But, and when they say but, that's when you know you have a problem.
Mm-hmm.
He said, but, he said, there's this other song. He said, it's number one all around the world right now, but it's not out in America yet. It'll be out here in 6 weeks. He said, I want you guys to go in the studio tomorrow and rush record this and one other side. We're going to release it as a 45 within 2 weeks and put like $200,000 worth of publicity behind it. And he puts the song on, and it's Pop Music by M. You know, pop music, yeah. Talk about pop. And we sat there sort of in horror, and, you know, it finished, and we said, that's a novelty song.
Yeah, and that's not at all what you sounded like or anything.
And he said, yeah, but it's going to be a big hit. And we said, well, yeah, but it's really not who we are. And he finally said, look, he said, do the song. He said, I guarantee with the promotion we put behind it, it's going to go top 20, maybe top 10, he said. So open the door. In comes Lonely Hearts after that, blah, 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 blah. So long story short, we said no. And they ended up not re-signing us. And the song went to number one and stayed there for like 3 or 4 weeks. So, you know, I mean, you can sort of wrestle with these things all day long. At the end of the day, it was the decision we made, and that's what we did. But
and you'd never know if your band would have...
Yeah.
Right. It wouldn't have sounded like that.
It wouldn't have sounded like that. No.
No.
No. And, you know, because we didn't, you know, I mean, I, at heart, we didn't want to do a novelty song, you know, because we didn't want to become known as that. You know, people who do novelty songs don't generally go on to industrious careers, you know, so.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I couldn't imagine him being given that set of, like, being told what to do that way.
After
by
that.
The company. Yeah. Not without hearing from him mightily.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there's a rumor that I heard once. Maybe it was from you that he and one of those women in that video got together and got married.
Yeah, I that's what I had read. I there's an Asian woman in the video, and I my understanding was that was who he ended up getting married to.
Huh. So. Pretty cool. I wonder if that worked out. Who knows?
I think they were married right up to the time he died, I believe.
Oh, yeah. Good. Nice end to his story. Yeah. All right. So at 9:39 in the morning, let's hear some Robert Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about there's so many great songs that he's got, but we tried to pick a couple that would show off the kind of sound that he's known for. I'm not going to play Addicted to Love because that's too well known, but have two songs we talked about: Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley. Besides the fact that it rhymes like that, it's a fantastic track, and Bad Case of Lovin' You.
Yeah, which is a great tune.
Yeah, anything you'd like to say about those two before we spin them?
No, I mean, other than the fact that, you know, Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley was like, I think that was his first solo album. And
I think so.
That was kind of like his declaration of independence, if you will. And then Bad Case of Loving You, I think, was the first real mainstream hit that he had.
It's such a great rock and roll song.
But that's a song where the melody doesn't move a lot in it, but it's his vocal performance that sells it.
Yeah, unlike Sneakin' Sally, because that's a different type of song.
Yes.
It's certainly not expected, but you're right. I mean, Bad Case, I mean, he just screams on there, and it really shows who he was.
Absolutely.
All right, so let's hear those songs first. We're Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley. This is a look at Robert Palmer here at WMFO.
Thank you.
WMFO in Medford, 9:48 in the morning. Boy, the time goes fast, doesn't it, Fred?
It does,
it
indeed.
Does. Just heard Bad Case of Loving You and Sneakin' Sally Through the Alley, both by the great Robert Palmer. All right, as we move through your career exploits and meetings with the luminaries of the day, the motels, in my mind, it's always not just the motels, but it's Martha Davis and the motels.
Absolutely.
I mean, she was it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, she was the anchor in that band, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about your experiences with Martha Davis and the Motels.
Well, we opened some shows for them. I can't remember exactly how many. You know, they were really interesting band. They had a lot of layers to them. Very nice people as well. And the one gig I remember playing with them sort of vividly is Hampton Beach Casino in New Hampshire.
Okay.
And I remember that gig because they were touring on their first album, which had just become a big hit. And we were hanging around in the dressing room. We were all together. And I was talking with Martha, and I said to her, I said how much I liked her songwriting. I liked the album. And I said, So how many songs have you got queued up for the second album? And she laughed and she said, I haven't even started writing songs for the second album. and I said, really? And she said, yeah. I said, geez. I always imagine, you know, when you're on the road like this, I mean, you know, having been on the road, there's a lot of downtime. I would imagine you'd be plugging away at songs. She said, nah. She said, I'll, you know, she said, if I remember correctly, she said something about working better under pressure. So she said, you know, when it gets closer and, you know, the wolf's at the door, then I'll start writing songs. So
I see,
you know, so that was an interesting, comment, but, yeah, they're just kind of a cool band. They were just nice people.
Yeah. And you were telling me that, originally when they got signed, her boyfriend was the guitar player who was sort of lording over everything. And the producer didn't agree with what was going on. And the two of them broke up. Talk a little bit about, the producer said he wanted to re-record that guy.
Yeah. I mean, this was told to me by one of the band, you know, a guy she was involved with at the time was the guitar player in the band, and he was kind of lording over the band. And they got signed, and they were doing the album, and he and the producer were at loggerheads a lot because he wanted the band to be more of a hard rocky sort of thing. And the producer heard other textures in the music. So they had gotten the album pretty much done, and then she and the boyfriend broke up, and he was out of the band. So the producer pulled what I thought was a really ballsy move for someone at that time, particularly with a band doing their first album. He got a hold of the label and said, look, I want to re-record this album. I want to re-record the album. He said, I think we have a hit on our hands, but not in its current form. He said, and they let him do it. So they went back in the studio and they recut it using the producer's guidance, and they came out with that huge blockbuster of an album.
Mm-hmm. You know? And are we talking about the one, All for One, in 1974?
I think that was it. The very first album.
I think that's the one.
Yeah.
With that great song that we want to play, Only the Lonely.
Only the Lonely. I mean, yeah, gosh. I mean,
what do you say about that?
Well, you know, as with so many, I mean, it's a great song, but it's really her vocal. It's really her vocal. I mean, she just, the texture of her voice and the way she puts the song across is really what sells it.
The way she puts the song across. You've got to be able to deliver a song.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And she just has a lot of depth to her voice. Oddly enough, at that point in time when she'd go out on stage, she'd be out on stage with a bottle of Jack. And she'd be nipping at that Jack all during the show.
Really?
So yeah. So it was really kind of an interesting dichotomy to hear her sing a song like that. And you know, you identify something like that with Janis Joplin or something or somebody like along those lines. But
definitely
yeah.
Not her.
No. But she, whatever she did, it worked.
Yeah. And this song, I mean, it's 1982. It's not. If you say 1980s to me, this is not what I think of. I mean, it's sort of like the pop music thing that you talk about. Yeah. So this is such a departure, I think. But they put it out, and boy, did it blow up.
Oh, yeah, blew up big time.
Yeah. All right, so let's play what we're talking about here from The Motels. Just a great, great song delivered by Martha Davis. This is Only the Lonely at WMFO.
We walked the loneliest mile. We smiled without any style. We kissed altogether wrong, no intention. We lied about each other's. We'll be right back.
It's WMFO in Medford. Wow, I mean, it's, you know, as many times as I've heard that song, and you too as well, Fred. I mean, it's you can't help just being brought right into it.
Yeah, transported.
And you had mentioned that I said that the guitar solo was just very understated, kind of.
Mm.
And you mentioned that the whole song really is being kept together by her vocals, which you mentioned, but that bass line.
The bass line.
That thumping bass line.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then that solo in the middle, I mean, sure, you've got the guitar, which you would mention is a more rock and roll-y type of
tone.
Thing. But then the solo, the sax solo comes in by the keyboard player.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing just really worked. I mean, what a pro job and a song that'll last forever.
Yeah, it's a good example of how a producer who knows what they're doing can really elevate the material. You know, there are a lot of producers who aren't that talented, but this particular one was.
Well, I'm sure that they all appreciate that, but I'm sure it's true. I'm sure it's true. All right, so at 9:57, almost 9:58 in the morning, I want to take care of a little bit of business, and we'll come back right after the top of the hour, and we're going to talk a little bit about a band called Squeeze. We'll be back right after this.
Hey, Dad, how do you throw a curveball? How do you build a fort? How do refrigerators run? How do fish learn how to swim?
Kids ask a lot of questions.
How high can you jump?
But you don't have to know every answer.
How many phone numbers are there?
Because you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent.
How do cell phones work?
There are thousands of children in foster care who don't need every question answered.
What's electricity?
They just need you.
What's the moon made of?
For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt U.S. Kids, and the Ad Council.
This is more like it.
You're listening to WMFO Medford.
All right, and with that top of the hour ID, make the FCC happy. I'm Mike. I've been with you since 9. I'll be here till 11 when Something About the Women comes in. I think today it's going to be our friend Jane, so I look forward to that for sure. And I'm here with Fred Pinault, who's talking about all of his interesting exploits, being in a band that got to tour the world, the Atlantics, from right here in Boston.
Well, we got to tour the whole country. We didn't get to tour the whole world.
You didn't get over the pond at all?
No. Unfortunately, you know, at the end of the Roxy Music Tour, they went to Japan, and we went back to Hollywood. So.
Oh, that's kind of, Do you wish that turned out differently, or?
Oh, yeah. Are you kidding? Yeah, that'd be great. You
know? I mean, I just assumed, didn't I? But
yeah. No. We had records out all over the world. We had Sony release the Big City Rock album in Japan. It was out in South America. It was out in Europe. As a matter of fact, in England, they released the single in America was One Last Night. But the single in England was a song called Television Girl that was on the album. So it's amazing the different ways that different countries interpret your material.
Yeah, it's amazing to me you guys didn't get to go over there at least once since it was played there.
I know. But hey, what are you gonna do?
What are you gonna do? All right, so let's continue with a band that all of us know, and the musicianship in this band, Squeeze, is unbelievable. The songwriting was fantastic.